When Stephen Tobolowsky arrived at SDPB's Black Hills Bureau last week, he entered dancing and singing If I Were a Rich Man from Fiddler on the Roof. The lanky actor, whose bald head and kindly face is immediately familiar to his fans, is accustomed to stealing the scene. He's unforgettable as insurance salesman Ned Ryerson in the movie Groundhog Day. He's had roles in around 200 movies, including Memento, Mississippi Burning, Bird on a Wire, and Thelma and Louise. And he's been in 100 or so TV or Netflix shows, including Californication, Deadwood, The Goldbergs, and the new version of One Day at a Time. He often plays a comedic role, but there's a serious side to him. Tobolowsky returned to his Jewish roots as an older adult and threw himself into studying and following tradition. Part of this reflection has included principles of science and math. The actor, author, musician, and podcast host recently made a few stops in South Dakota promoting his latest book, My Adventures with God, and serving as a special guest at the Aberdeen Film Festival. Traveling with him was actress Anne Hearn, his wife, and the mother of his two grown sons. Last Tuesday, Tobolowsky gave a talk at the Dahl Arts Center in Rapid City, and the following morning stopped by the Black Hills Surgical Hospital studio, where he had a long talk with Victoria Wicks about science, faith, and the beauteous nature of the unknown.
When I was a little boy, I either wanted to be an actor to hang out with monsters or be a scientist because, of course, scientists made monsters. You know, they were always in the laboratory making monsters from my point of view. But as I grew up, I just thought science was the answer to everything. I made weather stations with my brother and studied meteorology. I took classes when I was still in the single digits, you know, 9 and then 10, 11 years of age at the Natural History Museum in Dallas in geology. And I loved geology, loved rock collection, loved fossils. One fossil I found ended up in a museum. So I thought I was bound and determined to be a geologist. Loved science in terms of where math intersects with science, like physics and calculus. I loved the idea of mathematics. And then I loved where arts intersected with science, like music and poetry. So I found science always led the way in my life, and I was really happy there. But science is not good at explaining lots of mysteries. It doesn't do that very well. I was in Los Angeles waiting to be interviewed by Leonard Maltin, and his radio station was in a comic book store, and underneath there was a physicist, an astrophysicist who was selling comic books to make a living, because astrophysicists don't do too well, apparently. So I started asking him questions about the beginning of the universe, and he was smiling and saying, to tell you the truth, science is not really interested in a good story. What we try to do is we try to prove the laws of physics one way or another, and then invent a story that fits those laws. And once we find out that our findings were wrong, we throw the story out and we start over again. So I said, so would it be correct to saying that science is not interested in a good story, but an accurate outline? And he said, yes, that's it. So I think as humans, we do like good stories. And so we need something more than science in our life. And that made me reach out more to the arts.
Does understanding of how the universe works help you to build your spirituality?
That is the essential question. And the way religion works with this question is, I'll take a look at Judaism, since that's what I know the most of, since I'm Jewish. And that is, you have a religion that's 6,000 years old. And if you take a look at civilization, you find that mankind goes through periods of time in which we believe the truth can be known. And then we have other periods of historical record in which we believe the truth cannot be known. And the only way the truth can be known is through shamans, through mysticism, or smoking a little marahuchi. Some sort of thing. Maybe rock and roll helps us there too. So on one hand, you have Einstein. On the other hand, you have Woodstock. And they're battling it out throughout the history of man. You take a look at Judaism, you have a layer cake of periods of time in which civilization thought they could know everything, and you have the Ten Commandments, right? 10 rules as to how to live a good life. Simple, that's it. And then you have periods of time in which we believe you cannot know the truth, and you have the Jewish mystics, the Zohar, in the Talmud, the Jewish Talmud, which, for people who don't know it, is the set of works, the second most holy works in Judaism. They have whole sections about bleeding, bloodletting, bleeding, because it used to get you high.
Really?
Yeah, that they used to see visions if you bled yourself enough. And mystics, Jewish mystics, to understand the truth of the world and the universe, used to bleed themselves to, you know, get to that point where they could see beyond what is apparent in our world. So in terms of your question about science, science is always trying to find ways to look beyond the veil of our lack of understanding and look into the subatomic world and understand the quantum world to see why things operate in such an unusual way. Religion works the same way. It works either in the simplicity of the Ten Commandments, or it works in a mystical way if you go to the book of Leviticus, where they say the most important rules are, do not curse the deaf, do not put an obstacle before the blind. And now you're getting into a realm of, I don't want to say metaphysics, because that's not really what it is, but you're talking about something that isn't a fact, but in the moral realm, which is a gray area. Now, we would all agree that those are two good things to do, mm-hmm. not to put an obstacle, but there's no argument there, I think.
Right. But then you get into stoning your children because they talked back.
Well,
yeah.
Now that's interesting. Now it's interesting that you bring that up. That's an interesting thing there that is in the Bible about stoning that bad boy because he didn't obey the Sabbath. It's the interesting thing about the story is that to stone the boy, you had to go to the elders of the community before you could do that. And so the real story is not that the boy was or was not stoned, but it was the first time where they said, Mom, Dad, you can't stone your children. You got to go to a higher authority before you do that. And so it was the beginning of justice for children. Because you think they weren't stoned before then? No. So it wasn't saying, yeah, go ahead, stone your kids if they misbehave. They were always being stoned. They were always being killed. It was saying, no, 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 no. Like in the Talmud, they talk about if you violate the Sabbath, it is an offense where you get killed. What do you call that? I haven't had enough coffee. It's a capital offense.
Yeah.
Capital offense. You are killed if you violate the Sabbath. However, if you then you start reading what all these rabbis are saying. However, before you kill the person for violating the Sabbath, you have to have two witnesses that watch the person violating the Sabbath. And these two witnesses have to warn the person in this specific way that if you keep doing what you're doing, we're going to report you, and it's a capital offense, and you'll be killed. And then those two people have to go. In other words, you have this enormous bureaucratic framework that says, you ain't going to get stoned. It's impossible for these conditions to be met for you to get stoned. Well, stoned by stones.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
So religion stepped in and filled a void, it sounds, as if, you know, lawlessness was replaced by religious tenets.
Yes, and
I think the same thing happened with Islam, and you know, that there was tribal law, but there was not any kind of collective law, and Islam filled that void there too.
I was saying last night at the talk I had here, in the Old Testament, and Jewish scholars out there will know more than me, I believe there's 41 different Hebrew words for God, and they all mean a different thing. One is Lord, one is El Shaddai, which is the destroyer.
Mm.
Help me, please. You know, you have words that mean God of mercy, God of love, God of righteousness and law, and different concepts of God. And so you got to be careful which concept you grab onto.
Is it Orthodox tradition that the word God is not said? He whose name shall not be said, or
I know the it is the Orthodox tradition. You don't write the word of God.
It's
G hyphen D because you don't want to throw it away. Mm-hmm. You don't want to throw it away. What I found about Judaism, which is very useful, is that Judaism is all about boundaries, not about punishments. And then they're like my wife with our finances. She's in charge of our finances, Anne is. So, you know, she said, Stephen, we have to have a rainy day fund. And I said, okay, sounds good to me. And then she came up to me a year later, says, and we also have to have an emergency fund. And we also have to have a trampoline fund in case somehow we fall and we need to be able to bounce. We have all these damn funds. And I can't buy new golf clubs because the money has to go into the new fund. So Judaism draws all of these boundaries, and a boundary beyond another boundary, and a boundary beyond another boundary. We were talking about this last night. Let's take kosher food. Okay, I'm in South Dakota. There's no way you can get through a day without eating a pig. You cannot do it. You will order a peanut butter sandwich, and they're going to put a pork chop on it. Being kosher, you don't eat pork, and you don't eat shellfish. So my wife converted to Judaism, and there's an old joke. Don't marry a shiksa, because when they become Jewish, they become far more Jewish than you ever were. So Anne says, like, we are going to honor the laws of kosher. And I have all sorts of friends on One Day at a Time who are very interested in this because they go like, why? Why wouldn't you eat pork? You know? Mm. And some people said, well, I think it was the old Food and Drug Administration that they didn't have a good way of taking care of pork in the old days, so it's healthier not to eat pork. No, that ain't the reason that the rabbis say.
What did the rabbis say?
In Leviticus, you have the laws of kosher next to the laws of sexual propriety. Mm. So first you have the kosher laws, then you have the laws about don't have sex with your family, and don't have sex with your wife's family. And you have all these laws about sexual prohibition. The idea being boundaries and boundaries and boundaries. If you can control what you eat, you can control more difficult things to control, like your sexual desires.
Oh.
So the whole thing is like training wheels for having self-control.
Okay. I always thought it was because shellfish and pigs are just kind of the trash bins of the animal world.
Well, yeah, and but you know, one of the interesting things in that section of the Bible, which I love, is another thing that's prohibited is eating centipedes.
Ew.
And yeah.
No problem.
But yeah, but what that means is that there were dudes out there eating centipedes. I mean, there was somebody going like, we got to make a law against old Jethro there. He's eating centipedes.
One of the things I've come to as I've grown older is that science and religion and art and music and poetry and such are all trying to define the same thing, trying to tap into the same power.
Oh, are we on the same track there?
Well, that's why I wanted to interview you.
I have a theory on this, because I always wondered where our fear of the dark went, because I was so scared of the dark when I was a child. And my theory is this, that over the centuries, man's fear of the dark was transformed into science, art, and religion. Science to measure the darkness, art to show us its beauty, and religion to teach us that it's really light all the time. You just have to be able to believe in the light to see it. So I think it all comes from fear, specifically fear of the dark.
I guess I saw it more as a searching for something that's really beautiful, but we can't quite grab onto it unless we... Have you heard about those caves where there are red dots on the ceiling, or they're painted dots on the ceiling? And people exploring them figured out really good acoustics right here. Yeah, you sing and you get like chords going. So it's just like this something inside of us always trying to tap into something that is so beautiful that we understand is there, but we're not sure how to define it.
That is a concept that is very profound, because it ask the questions, what is beauty? And that we have an innate sense of what is beautiful. Because I got to tell you, my cat doesn't know what's beautiful. My cat doesn't know that at all. But to your point, we were in France and we visited the Lascaux Caves.
Oh, nice.
And I thought, oh, I know what this is going to be. You know, the guys are in there painting the horses and painting the bison. You guys say bison up here?
Well, it's crazy talk. Well,
it's bison. In the Lascaux Caves, I thought, I'm going to go in there and I'm going to see these paintings of animals on the walls. No, you are correct. They had a herd of horses that started galloping on the side of the cave, and the herd expanded as it went up to the top, and then over your head, over the top of the cave, there were hundreds of giant abstract horses running, and I almost fell to the ground because of the beauty of it.
Yes.
The beauty of it. These guys, these cave people, these troglodytes, were not trying to scientifically note what they were seeing outside of their cave. They were trying to show us how it made them feel, how a herd of horses made them feel. They stepped over the line into not a literal representation, but an artistic representation that was beautiful. Like the question I have, let's take music. What the hell is the authentic cadence? The authentic cadence, the 1/5. And it is the center of all of our music. And when we hear it, there is something in that bum, bum, that idea that makes us feel complete. In Judaism, there's the word we've all heard somewhere, shalom. Shalom means mm-hmm. peace. Shalom means hello. Shalom mm-hmm. means all things. But what shalom also means is whole, complete, an idea that is congruency. And humans have this concept of congruence, of the authentic cadence, of beauty, which I think is unique to us. And you could argue that that may be the peace that we say is the divine peace and the peace that's made in God's image, whatever you call God, whatever of the 41 words you use for God is beauty. Because that is not a concept that's universal.
And that's another attempt to define something that we don't know, is those different ideas of God. Perhaps?
Yes. And you know, it was a huge difference moving from the national God ideas of 6,000 years ago, that every nation had a God, and the idea that there's one God everywhere. And you could see in man's struggles that happening. When the oneness, the idea of oneness, that we're all part of the same thing, dissolves into tribes, into nations, that's when we have North Korea and all that stuff. That's where we are now.
They don't worship our God.
And we're going more in that direction. Everything is being tainted with the idea that we're breaking into pieces, as opposed to understanding that we're part of the same beautiful thing. So however cynical people want to be about religion, it provides a unity that isn't a scientific unity, but is a unity based on beauty and the idea that beauty is something beyond us, but we can touch and make it part of us. And in the reach, hey, what is a prayer? What is a prayer? A prayer is always something we don't have that we want. So it's a bridge between what we are and what we hope to be. And I don't think there's a better definition for beauty than that.
Mm.
You know, the gap between what we are and what we hope to be is beauty.
That takes me to the notion of God. Someone asked you, how do you envision God? How do you envision that power? And you didn't mention a white man with a beard sitting on a cloud.
No,
you have a different idea.
Well, the thing is this. When I write like my adventures with God, one of the problems you have when God is one of the characters in your story is, what are you talking about? Because clearly the God in those Bible stories, when you first learned them when you're a toddler, is completely different than when you're in your 20s and you see God in your girlfriend's eyes. And it's completely different when you're in your 30s and you're playing rock and roll and you hit that authentic chord with the help of a little cannabis and you feel God moving through your body and you go, yeah, that's God, man. And then when you're married and you're standing before the preacher or priest or somebody in a field and you pledge your love, you see God differently then. And when you have children, God changes. And when that child is in the emergency room at 1 a.m. in the morning, God changes again. And when you lose your family and you're sitting there and you're putting them in the ground, you get yet another version of God. So what are we talking about? What we have, if you remember Algebra 2, if you have an equation with two unknowns, you don't get an answer. What you get is a graph, between the X and Y axis. So we are changeable entities through time. Our notion of God changes as we age. It's not a fixed point. So we are an equation with two unknowns. So we ain't going to get an answer to that. That ain't going to happen. But we have to be aware of who we are and what we see as divine in that particular part of our life.
You talked about the notion of charity, and in Latin, the definition that Christians rely on, it would be caring or loving. But in Hebrew, it's translated as justice, and I'm not going to try to pronounce the word.
Yeah, tzedakah. Yeah, it's in Christianity, the root word for charity is the Latin word that comes from love. But in Judaism, the root word, the Hebrew word that is charity, comes from justice. And I was doing a book thing, I think in Los Angeles, and someone asked me, what's the difference between Christianity and Judaism? Here's one right there. That charity, be it an act of love, or charity, is it an act of justice? Those are two huge differences. In Christianity, you forgive everything and everyone all the time. You have somebody go into a church in the South and shoot some people, and you have someone in another church saying, we forgive you for that action. In Judaism, that would be outlawed. You don't do that. You cannot do that. There is a formula for forgiveness in Judaism, and there are some things that there is no forgiveness for. Believe it or not, you don't get forgiven for murder because you cannot make restitution for murder. One of the keys for forgiveness is the person who wrongs another has to be able to make restitution. You cannot return a life. The other is adultery, because you cannot return a family that you break up. You cannot return the wholeness of a family. And the next one, drum roll, is gossip. You cannot forgive gossip because you cannot return a reputation. And that is our ABC, NBC, CBS, and cable television lineup, murder, adultery, and gossip.
No
forgiveness there in Judaism for those things.
You know, you look at dark matter, and Einstein said he was looking for the secrets of the old one. And then you look at some people's concept of God, which is a unifying force in the universe. And I'm just kind of thinking astrophysicists and theologians are looking for the same thing, trying to define the same thing. And when I think about it, I think about justice and dispassionate justice.
It's such a beautiful concept of justice. And Shakespeare brings the beauty of it with Portia. You know, the quality of mercy is not strained. That justice has to be a combination of righteousness, like in Judaism, mixed with love. And of the names of God in the Old Testament, there is the God of righteousness, of following the laws, and there is the God of mercy. And always there is a wedding between justice and mercy. And if you think about it, that requires science in terms of knowing what justice is. And it requires love in knowing what mercy is. And wisdom is the merging of those two. Wisdom is difficult.
It's something you come to with age, it seems like. Are there wise children?
Or wise children. I remember my son was upset, and we were punishing him. I said, I gave you a second chance, you know, and you didn't listen to me. And he started crying. He says, but no, Daddy, all I want is another second chance. And I almost sat down on the sidewalk and started to cry. I said, Robert, come here. I said, that's all any of us want, is another second chance. You just said the essence of all religion is that as mankind, we want another second chance. If you live just by justice, you don't get that. That is nature. The old are left to fend for themselves. The weak are torn apart by the strong. That's nature. Nature is not your friend. But with the annulling force of God, then comes mercy, then comes wisdom, and maybe you have a life in which you find beauty, the authentic cadence.
You and your son, Robert, he is a scientist.
Yes.
And you have discussions that seem to be a bit contentious at the dining room table, and Anne is saying, no, don't fight, don't fight. There's an old tradition of faith versus reason. You know, Jonathan Swift was absorbed with that when he wrote Gulliver's Travels. And so it seems to me that that's what you're arguing. You're arguing faith. He's arguing reason. But I see you taking away what he said and applying it to your thoughts on faith. So you seem to be learning from your son as you are possibly influencing him.
Yeah, my son is no ordinary science. He is a doctorate in organic chemistry at UCLA.
And then he told you there is no such thing as organic chemistry.
Yeah, with a sarcastic eye roll, that all chemistry is chemistry and organic is because they work with carbon chains. Uh-huh. But, you know, Robert teaches me a lot all the time because he's on the cutting edge. He actually has created something in organic chemistry that was patented by UCLA. He's quite a brilliant guy. So I always listen to him, but I listen to him more than he listens to me. He thinks I'm an old fuddy-duddy.
Well, that's the wisdom of age.
That's the wisdom of age. and it's good for youth to think that the wisdom of age is weakness in wisdom's clothing. The essence of all religion, in a nutshell, is when we're able to get to a point to where we say, I have enough. And if you look at every Bible story, the wars end when one of the people says, you know, I have enough. That's Jacob and Esau hugging each other. They both had enough. When you have enough, then you lose the ambition and then you're at peace. And religion teaches you that you do have enough. Even sometimes if you don't have enough, or what the world tells you you don't have enough, like people who take vows of poverty. But when we feel like we have enough in our soul is when we have peace. And that is the job of religion. That isn't what science teaches. Science does not teach whether you have enough or don't have enough. Science doesn't care. Science doesn't care about that at all. But our human hearts do care. When we feel we don't have enough, we live our lives feeling insecure that we are not enough and we don't have enough. And religion is what gives us the wisdom to understand what enough is and that we've always had it.